Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
It is a nightmare scenario. A business meeting held with the best intentions unintentionally spreads a devastating virus to thousands of people. A new report by researchers at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard and released before peer review suggests that's just what happened with the now infamous Biogen conference held at the Marriott Long Wharf in February. Here's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh reacting to the findings on CNN last night.
This is an eye-opener for the rest of the country, for people to see what this one event did. This one event happened back in February. At that point, we had, I think, 6 cases of coronavirus here in the city of Boston. And then it just multiplied, and we within a matter of weeks, less than weeks, we shut everything down here in the city of Boston.
So here to discuss the report is WBUR Common Health reporter Angus Chen. Angus, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
Also with us is WBUR Common Health editor Carrie Goldberg. Hey there, Carrie. Welcome back.
Hey there, Tiziana. Thanks.
So, Angus, I'll start with you. This report suggests 40% of all COVID infections in Boston, 3% of the U.S., coming from this one meeting. How did researchers even track that?
They use mutations in the coronavirus that they linked to the Biogen conference. Although I have to say, it's 40% of COVID-19 infections in the Boston area, but 3% of genome sequence in the U.S., not 3% of U.S. infections overall. But yes,
well, I'm sorry, I got to stop you there, yeah. Angus. What's the difference between a genome sequence and infections? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so every coronavirus has a genome that is a little bit distinct sometimes from other coronaviruses that are also SARS-CoV-2 viruses, the thing that causes COVID-19. But a virus of the same genome can infect multiple people, but it can also, but you can also have like different genomes out there that's actually what the researchers are studying. They're looking at all these different genomes. So, you know, 40% of all COVID-19 infections in the Boston area, that could be from one genome or it could be from 100 genomes.
Got it. Thanks. Please go ahead.
Right. So the researchers are looking at mutations that are different between different different coronavirus genomes. It's important to know that the coronavirus mutates as it spreads. These are basically small, usually small, inconsequential mutations that don't change anything fundamental about the virus itself, but does get passed on from person to person and can create this distinctive genetic signature. It's best to kind of think of this as a photocopy. Like every time the virus reproduces, it makes a photocopy of itself. And sometimes that photocopy is a little messed up. So then when you go and photocopy the photocopy, all those little mistakes get passed on. That's essentially what happened at the Biogen conference. A distinct mutation emerged just before the virus entered the conference, coming from Europe, most likely. And then that virus photocopied itself at the conference and gave birth to the second distinct mutation at or just after the conference. So every time the researchers found those same mutations somewhere else, they have a pretty good idea this infection stemmed somehow from that conference. The researchers at the Broad have been sequencing coronavirus genomes from COVID-19 patients all over the Boston area and looking at genomes that their colleagues sequenced around the world. And as we know now, they found that genetic fingerprint associated with the conference all around the world. Here's how Bronwyn McInnes, a viral genomicist at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, and a senior author on the report, put into context just how wide an impact this one event seems to have had.
It is striking. It certainly has had an impact on the trajectory of the pandemic domestically and abroad. Just another great example of how connected we all are and how the viruses are fairly agnostic to how they move and who they infect.
You know, from this one event, this one conference, we see infections going into, you know, people who are high-powered biotech executives, to a significant portion of Boston's homeless population. You know, it really fundamentally altered Massachusetts and to an extent, the rest of the planet.
So Carrie, let me turn to you now. I remember us talking about the potential of super spreading events at the beginning of all of this. Did these results surprise you?
Well, they they didn't surprise me. They really struck me, just the magnitude of the impact that one super spreading event could have. Like, it, not to make light of it, but it made me say, like, maybe we need another term, like super duper spreading events or super spreading events for the really gigantic sources like this one. And as you say, you know, we've known since very early on that super spreaders tend to be key to this and other pandemics, but 40% of our local cases from one gathering. Like, to me, that's pretty incredible, especially when you consider that at that point, there were a lot of people still coming into the country from various places. And I'd add that, you know, although the findings since then have been really consistent that super spreader events are central to the continuing spread of the pandemic, some researchers are even saying now that if we could just end them, we could end the pandemic, which is why I can really understand, you know, when Governor Baker sounds like big gatherings are driving him crazy, you can really feel for him.
And just briefly, Carrie, results like this, what do they tell us about the public health response at the time of the conference and in the days after?
Well, it was very early days, right? But the most obvious thing it seems to me they tell us is that it made no sense to close the door only to China back then when the virus was already clearly spreading in Europe and there were lots of people coming in still from Europe and other places. It's really easy to have 2020 hindsight, but also you just can't help but think that if big gatherings had just been banned even just a little earlier, it could have made a really big difference.
Angus, I want to pick up on a thread from when you were describing the results of the report, because you made reference to its spread to Boston's homeless population, and that really was striking. I read that of the 193 samples the researchers collected from people experiencing homelessness, 122 appear to be linked to this conference. How do people think that even happened?
Yeah, so the researchers think that they caught two infections that seem to have gone directly from, or I should say at least two infections, that seem to have gone directly from someone associated with the conference to someone experiencing homelessness. How that happened exactly is totally impossible to know. You know, it could be someone who was in a shelter, who lived in a shelter and also worked at the venue where the conference was held or somehow interacted with a conference attendee. You know, you could imagine that someone at the conference, maybe an attendee, maybe a hotel worker, volunteered or worked at a homeless shelter as well. But whatever the pathway was, once these infections got into the shelter, it spread really fast and really widely, creating big clusters of new infections. Dr. Jesse Gaeta is the chief medical officer of the nonprofit Boston Healthcare for the Homeless and also worked on the study. She says the results are a call for better public health strategies.
It shows us just that we're not only a small community in Boston, but we're a small community nationally. And so we've got to figure out how to protect vulnerable populations better.
You know, unfortunately, a lot of the times people who live in these congregate living facilities like shelters or assisted living homes, nursing homes, that kind of thing, are also at the greatest risk to COVID-19 complications. And so Gaeta says we need to do better at making sure these communities are better protected from infection, because once an infection is introduced there, it's almost impossible to stop. And the consequences can be just devastating.
Well, it sounds like it. You know, Carrie, you've over the months participated in a number of our doctor call-ins, and we often talk about research with the doctors. And because of that, I want to talk about an important caveat here. This paper is not yet peer-reviewed. It's not published in a scientific journal. Does that change how we should respond to or interpret these findings?
Well, Tiziana, the fact that this is what's called a preprint doesn't concern me for a few reasons. One is that this paper comes from an incredibly impressive bunch of researchers. Another is that even if this individual paper is wrong, it's still part of this growing hill or mountain of evidence that super spreader events are really important in this pandemic. But I think most of all, you know, it's not in a traditional scientific journal yet. It hasn't been, as you say, peer reviewed, but it's on what's called a preprint server, which is called MedArchive. It's spelled Med, capital R, XIV, that does screen its research before it's posted, even though they don't do a formal peer review. So it's true that it's sort of not fully cooked, but it's cooked enough that I'll eat it personally.
Yes. And are we... That one's going to stick with me, Carrie. Are we in a time where, that's great, where we can't afford to wait for new science to go through the peer review process? And I wonder, does that raise questions about the speed of the peer review process?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, we're catching a time when scientific publications are very much in flux. And that's a big piece of it, that the process has traditionally been very slow. And you're absolutely right that at a time like this, we do not have the time for the typical months and months that it can take to get into a traditional journal. Those journals like Science and Nature and New England Journal of Medicine are still the gold standard in science and medicine. But the preprint servers, these sort of more upstarty, instant online servers have been rising for years, and they've become incredibly important during the pandemic. So for example, with a paper like this, like, it's worth noting that this is only a preprint, but in this case, it doesn't make me question the paper's validity. And I definitely think that this is one of those things that are going to last long after the pandemic. It was something that was ripe for change, that papers come out faster. I mean, if you think about it, why should a paper on cancer wait for months either? You know, we need this process can be sped up. And I think this could be a good thing that comes out of the pandemic.
And let me ask both of you. Go ahead, Angus. Go ahead.
Just to jump in here, this being a preprint doesn't mean it's not going to get peer reviewed eventually. That process is still going to happen. We just get a little window into this information before it's totally through the end of the process.
You know, the irony of this, let me ask both of you, Biogen's got to be dying at this point. As a company, it's a biotech company. Here it finds itself in the middle of this study with these results. Have either of you heard anything from them or heard any reactions from them?
Yeah, I have. Biogen as a company, throughout this whole pandemic and this process, have been really eager to share their employees and their data and their own super spreading events with researchers to find out how this happened and kind of further our understanding of how the coronavirus spreads, how it evolves, and how it behaves. I think that, a Biogen representative told me that they would never knowingly do anything to put their employees or anyone else at harm. And I have to believe that they're honest about that. Especially given how much they've worked to make this information public.
And I'm also, Carrie, go ahead.
Yeah, just, I would add that, you know, there's definitely an element of bad luck here. And experts on super spreading events say that although there are clear correlates to what a super spreading event will be, it tends to be indoors, it tends to be a lot of people, you know, hobnobbing closely, but there also is just an element of pure luck. And the only thing I would add is that it does seem as if often in these events, there's one person who has somehow been a personal super spreader. They were just, you know, shedding loads and loads of virus at maybe a window when they were most infectious, or they're louder talkers, or they're more gregarious. I so hope that Biogen, if they figure out who this person was, they don't need to name them, but it would be really fascinating to get a more granular idea of what actually happened physically, if that's at all possible.
All right. In our last minute or so, let me ask both of you, Angus and Carrie, what are your biggest takeaways for going forward now? Angus, how about you first?
The biggest takeaways for me are, one, a big super spreading event like this can have a really substantial impact on the communities outside of that immediate event. Now, it's always felt most locally, but as we see here, it can also have an influence that reaches all the way around the world. It's really important to think about that right now as we're opening up in different ways, most notably with schools and universities, where a lot of people are going to be interacting more in classrooms, athletic activities, study groups, and so on. It'll be really crucial to think about the ways we can prevent outbreaks and control them if they do happen. And second, once an infection, go ahead.
Well, no, I thought you were done. I was going to ask Carrie, but go ahead.
Oh, well, so once an infection begins spreading, another takeaway is that it goes around really, really fast, especially in congregate living shelters, like a like a shelter, a nursing home, or a college dorm, where people are in close quarters and share facilities. And one last thing is that, you know, we talk a lot about how crucial surveillance testing is, but this research shows that genomic surveillance can be really helpful too. You know, that's sequencing and monitoring the genomes of infections in real time to know where they're coming from and how they're spreading and evolving.
So keeping track of those photocopies. Carrie, how about you? Any big takeaways?
Yes, I would just add to Angus's last point, which is that, and in fact, I put a couple of them together. As colleges and universities reopen, we have this valuable new type of research that lets us track at a very granular level how the virus spreads. And that can be very useful. For example, if a college is trying to figure out how to respond to a little outbreak, they can see whether it came from outside and so tell people to stay in more, or whether there's really a lot of spread inside and they might need to close down. So it's just it's a kind of a new kind of DNA forensics that seems very useful at this moment.
Well, thank you both for walking us through it. That's WBUR Common Health reporter Angus Chen. Thanks, Angus.
Thank you.
And WBUR Common Health editor Carrie Goldberg, good to talk to you again, too. Thanks.
You're welcome.
The Republican National Convention taking place in Charlotte, North Carolina, is unconventional for a number of reasons this year, but that isn't stopping the party from pushing its number one agenda item, which is, of course, to reelect President Trump. Here is First Lady Melania Trump making the case for that from the Rose Garden last night and responding to some of the remarks made at last week's Democratic National Convention.
I don't want to use this precious time attacking the other side, because as we saw last week, that kind of talk only serves to divide the country further. I'm here because we need my husband to be our president and commander-in-chief for 4 more years. He's what is best for our country.
So, aside from another term, what is at stake for the president and the Republican Party leading into November, and what does that mean for the voters of Massachusetts? We'd like to get your reactions. Are you a Trump supporter, and are you watching the RNC this week? What do you think? Is it an effective set of messages to you? Are you on the fence? Is it an effective set of messages to you? And whether you're a supporter or not, are you finding it makes sense for you to concentrate on politics right now, or is it hard to focus on something like a national convention? 800-423-8255, that's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. So joining us to talk about everything that's happening this week is conservative political analyst Jennifer Braceras. Welcome back to the show, Jennifer.
Hi, Tiziana. Nice to be here.
I appreciate you joining us. So, Jennifer, we all knew that both conventions, DNC and RNC, would be not conventional, right? Had to be different. And the RNC tried to be a little less so, considering that does have some in-person elements to it, although very much scaled right down from a traditional convention. So with that in mind, and 3 days in now, how do you think it's going?
Well, I don't think that either convention went or can go as well as it would if they were in-person events. We didn't see Biden get the post-convention bounce that candidates usually get. And I think part of that is because these conventions are somewhat virtual and because, you know, as you mentioned in your opening, people are sort of focused on other things right now. It's a time, I think, where even people who love politics might not be tuning in for all of the obvious reasons.
Do you think that the president will also not get the traditional bounce from the RNC this week then too, Jennifer?
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. I certainly don't think he'll get as much of a bounce, but time will tell.
And what do you see as the party's main agenda as we head into the November election? What are they laying out this week as the case?
Well, I think it's interesting because they really have been focusing on 3 themes, as I see it: patriotism, capitalism, and the rule of law. And those are very traditional Republican themes. And they're themes that really appeal to conservatives and even moderates who don't like Donald Trump at all, right? To people who have problems with Donald Trump's character or his ethics find themselves sort of, I think, being brought back into the fold when they hear those messages. And I talked to one voter actually who is conservative leaning, but hadn't made up her mind because she dislikes Donald Trump so much. And after watching some of the speeches from Nikki Haley and Tim Scott and others, says she's convinced.
Let me just invite listeners into this conversation again, too. Are you convinced? Are you a voter who's been on the fence and trying to figure out which direction you should go? Or if you are a longtime President Trump supporter, are you getting the messaging you expected and wanted from the Republican National Convention this year? I'm going to go to a call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Matt on the line from Weymouth. Matt, you're on with me and Jennifer Braceras. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I got a concern, you know. So just a quick background, I was raised conservative. I grew up, you know, in a household that was conservative, but we didn't love guns. However, after watching the RNC last night, you know, I have a hard time figuring out what side of the fence I'm on. For instance, you know, I do have ties to the cannabis industry. So after listening to the fact that, you know, if we go into another shutdown, you know, we're going to let cannabis dispensaries stay open, as well as, you know, just all around listening to how they were talking about, you know, trans rights. You know, I'm somebody who has a lot of empathy and respect for people. So I just find myself more and more torn, you know, the further these debates go on and conventions go on.
Thanks for bringing your voice into this, Matt. Jennifer.
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, Matt mentions lockdowns. I think the Republicans are trying very hard to portray the Democratic Party as the party of shutdowns. And they're the party of, you know, they, the Republicans, want to portray themselves as the party of reopening and getting America back on track. And I do think that will resonate with a lot of people who have been very frustrated with the slow pace of the reopening.
I want to talk about some of the rhetoric, Jennifer. We heard a lot of critics of last week's Democratic National Convention, or even pundits supporting it, talking about some dark themes that were brought forward. And there have been some dark themes brought forward this week, too. One of the recurring lines of rhetoric has been the president as they said in one of the opening speeches, the bodyguard of Western civilization. And I want to play Kimberly Guilfoyle here, a Trump campaign senior advisor and now Donald Trump Jr.'s girlfriend, talking about how Democrats are seen as a threat to Western civilization.
They want to destroy this country and everything that we have fought for and hold dear. They want to steal your liberty, your freedom. They want to control what you see and think and believe so that they can control how you live. They want to enslave you to the weak, dependent, liberal, victim ideology to the point that you will not recognize this country or yourself.
You know, those are very strong words. And,
yeah.
And this idea of bodyguarding Western civilization, what is the argument about what needs to be bodyguarded?
Well, let me just start by saying, as somebody wrote in the National Review earlier today, that, you know, if Kimberly Guilfoyle had been a character on the West Wing, the producer of that show would have been rightfully raked over the coals for creating a caricature and a, you know, a cartoon-like portrayal of conservative women. I mean, that speech was just ridiculous. I don't care if you're for Donald Trump or you're a conservative. I thought that speech was somewhat embarrassing, and certainly, you know, doesn't speak for me or a lot of the Republicans I know. It had a very Evita Perón quality to it, sort of the way she was screaming and, you know, looking beautiful and coiffed, but, you know, screaming at to fire up the masses. I didn't care for it at all. So I don't know that she certainly was effective to some segment of the base that sort of share her approach. I think, you know, she certainly didn't influence any moderates or people who are on the fence, but I don't know that she deterred them either if they went on to watch other speakers.
I'm going to go to another call in a minute, but before I do, I want to follow up on that and say, so who this week has best spoken for and to you?
Well, I mean, I'm not just speaking, you know, for myself. I'm speaking
for
I think, a lot of voters that I've spoken to over the past few weeks. And I tend to speak to a lot of never Trump conservatives, right? I tend to speak to a lot of right-leaning moderates. And these people were all very impressed, as was I, with Senator Tim Scott, you know, with former Ambassador Nikki Haley, you know, Daniel Cameron, the young attorney general from Kentucky, only 34 years old, I thought was extremely impressive and well-spoken. You know, the Trump family members, the Kimberly Guilfoyles, the, you know, those people are to play, they're for the base. They're not going to convince people who might be Trump skeptical. But many of the other speakers, I think, were quite effective in convincing Trump skeptics.
I want to go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Mike on the line from Somerville. Mike, go ahead.
Hi, I just think that the era of globalization is kind of it's over, basically, with mass immigration and trade. And I think that Trump actually came out as kind of a moderate figure, saying, let's take a breather, let's step back a little bit from that. There's been a lot of harm done with that globalization mentality. And I think he did a good job of being inclusive with that message and having lots of speakers, people of color, and kind of saying, actually, this is about just taking a step back, just taking a breather. And so I thought that the convention was very good with the way it was structured.
Thanks for that call, Mike. And I want to pick up, Jennifer, on both Mike's note about inclusivity there and your note about the attorney general from Kentucky. That one in particular, I think, underscores some of the fault lines between what we heard in the DNC last week and at the RNC this week, because, of course, that's also the attorney general who critics would charge has not chosen to arrest police officers who were involved in the killing of Breonna Taylor. How do we deal with those fault lines in these 70 days or so before the November election? Is there a way for America to come together? Or are those fault lines so deep that we're just going to be separated?
Well, I think there are very deep fault lines on public policy, and I think it's sort of in worldview. But, you know, as Attorney General Cameron noted, and, you know, he's a young African-American man, you know, not all Blacks think alike. And he took on Vice President Biden for making not just one, but three or four comments suggesting that African-Americans are a monolithic voting group over his career. And I think that the way we come together is to recognize our diversity and our diversity of thought, and to recognize that we won't always agree, that there will often be very deep policy differences, but that doesn't make us, you know, traitors to our race. It doesn't make us racist. It just means we have to find areas of common ground, and we can only do that when we respect where the other side is coming from and not accuse them of bad motives. So I thought Daniel Cameron was very effective in speaking to that point.
So, you know, let's stay with that for a second. 8% of Black Americans voted for President Trump in the 2016 elections. Mm-hmm. And there are many in the Black community who have accused him very overtly of being racist, that there may be policies that have not been, but that the president is. Is there anything that has happened in the Republican National Convention this week that might sway Black voters? Do you think there's any chance in 2020 that a higher percentage go for Trump than did in 2016?
Well, I have to be honest with you, before the killing of George Floyd and you know, all of the protests and reaction we've seen since then, I actually thought that President Trump was on track to receive a larger share of the Black vote than any Republican in my lifetime. And part of that is because of his efforts on criminal justice reform that no other president of either party had taken on. And also just from the things that I've been hearing when I talk with Black voters, again, many of whom voted for President Obama, but seem to like this president. And, you know, I should say, I'm actually not somebody who really likes this president. I think you know that, Tiziana. I'm not a fan of his character. I didn't vote for him in 2016. So, you know, I'm very Trump skeptical, but I did see movement amongst Black voters towards President Trump after the criminal justice reform took place. I don't know, you know, I haven't really spoken to a lot of those people recently. I don't know how it's going to tip. I still think he'll get more than the 8% he got last time. I don't know that it'll be as high as I had originally predicted.
So Jennifer, I'm going to ask you to sit tight because I want to bring another voice into the conversation. We have Janet Fogarty, who's a delegate to the RNC this year and a national and state committee woman from Massachusetts in the state GOP. She's also the regional chair for Southeastern Massachusetts in the Cape and the Islands for the Trump-Pence campaign. Welcome to Radio Boston, Janet.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So you were at the convention in Charlotte. What was that like?
Well, it was great. It was very well organized. And, you know, of course, we were very COVID compliant. It was certainly different than 2016 and 2012. I was delegate for those conventions as well. Obviously, extremely scaled back, only about 300 delegates, six or seven from each state were able to attend. So of our 41, only six were able to be there. But it was, you know, it got the business of what it's all about done. So, and, you know, we did what we were there to do, and it was a success.
For you, Janet, what are the key agenda items that you want to see from the president and that you needed to hear this week?
He's everything that has been the speakers that have been on, you know, for the first night and the second night, and everyone has pretty much laid out what I think that the agenda of the convention is. You know, the land of promise, land, there's a theme. It's land of promise, land of opportunity, land of heroes, and land of greatness. So each night, the speakers that are selected are threading all of those themes together. And I think that so far I've seen what I've seen, it's working.
Janet, I know you know there are critics who would say that the opportunity and promise you're talking about haven't been available to some marginalized groups in the country. How does the party address that argument?
Well, I think that, as Jennifer mentioned, this president has been the president that has been able to increase Black Americans' job employment ratios pre-COVID, and, you know, even since COVID, as we start to reopen the country, the unemployment figures are gradually going down. But for Latinos and Black Americans, this president has been able to boost their economic standpoint in our society. Mm-hmm. So I think that it has been a success.
Janet, I will pick back up on the. Yeah. Just very quickly, for those who are on the fence or turned off by the president's rhetoric, what would you say to them?
Well, you know, I would say that just look at what he has done, what he has, you know, promises made, promises kept. He is someone who is not a politician by background, as we know. And there has been, you know, some missteps in along the way, being not a polished politician, but he has made promises and he's kept those promises. And you don't really find that in many politicians. And I think that if you look at what he has done and what he intends to do over the next 4 years, it's aggressive, but he will get it done. He will continue in the past 4 years, and he'll compound upon that in the next four.
That's Janet Fogarty, 2020 RNC delegate. Janet, I appreciate you taking the time today. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So Jennifer, I want to turn back to you for just a minute. I do want to pick up on the question of the coronavirus and COVID-19.
Yeah.
Because it is of note that the convention has not addressed the amount of loss of life, the disproportionate impact that the virus has had on people of color and low-income people in the country, and hasn't explored whether the country and the president and the administration did anything wrong. And I wonder, of course, you want to put your best foot forward in a convention, but any concerns with that?
Well, I think it's just what you said. It's conventions are about putting your best foot forward and inspiring optimism and hope. And you did see the First Lady mention it last night, which I thought was important. But I also think, you know, there's not a person out there who doesn't know that we've been dealing with the coronavirus pandemic for, you know, 6 months, who doesn't know how serious it is, who hasn't been touched by it or lost a loved one or had someone get sick. And, you know, most people are really looking for hope for the future. They're not, they don't want to hear negativity. And so I think it's smart politics, frankly, not to dwell on what we couldn't control, frankly, but to talk more about how we're going to rebuild, how we're going to reopen, hope for a vaccine, hope for treatments. I think that's what people want to hear.
Now, you know, there are going to be listeners saying, wait, there are things we could have controlled here.
Well, what do you think we could have controlled? I mean, you know, this is a virus. It doesn't, a virus is not political. A virus doesn't know borders. And there, yeah, yes, of course, there are things we could have controlled. We could have protected our elderly population better in our nursing homes. We could have protected the most vulnerable better. We could have not shut down the schools and frankly cost children months of academic progress. And, you know, you talk about how this disease has had disproportionate impact on poor communities and communities of color, and that's true, but so has the lockdown. And particularly the closure of schools has negatively impacted communities of color in ways that they might not be able to make up, that those particular students may not be able to make up. And that's very tragic. You know, I think the Republicans are talking a lot about reopening schools, about making sure that the poorest communities are served, because the rich kids are just sending their kids to private school, the rich people. So the shutdown hasn't hurt them.
I got to stop you there, Jennifer. There's so much more we could debate there, but I'm so grateful you came on. Conservative political analyst Jennifer Braceras, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Talk to you soon.
As our conversation before the break demonstrated, our political minds are wholly occupied this week with the upcoming elections. But here at Radio Boston, our stomachs are stuck in the recent past, last week, to be exact, at the Democratic National Convention.
Our state appetizer, calamari, is available in all 50 states. The calamari comeback state of Rhode Island casts one vote for Bernie Sanders and 34 votes for the next president, Joe Biden.
That is, of course, Joe McNamara, the chair of the Rhode Island State Democratic Committee. And we spoke with him on Radio Boston last week. And while that TV moment might have become a social media punchline for McNamara, calamari is serious business.
Many businesses, especially the restaurant industry in virtually every state, has been decimated by this pandemic. But on top of that, our fishing industry in Rhode Island that supplies many of the restaurants with quality seafood products was also devastated.
So we got to thinking, what is the real story behind Rhode Island's state appetizer? And how did calamari become king of the ocean state? Well, it turns out there's someone who can help us answer that. We are going to turn to an unlikely calamari expert, S.E. Cupp. She's a political commentator and host of CNN's S.E. Cupp Unfiltered, a columnist for the New York Daily News, and the reporter behind a Daily Beast expose titled The Rise of Calamari, Fueled by Rhode Island's Dirty Politics. S.E. Cupp, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Tiziana. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. I know you're a native New Englander, and I'm just curious. First, what was your reaction to Joe McNamara's use of calamari at the DNC for the roll call?
Well, my jaw dropped. I was watching like everyone else. And because I, you know, as you mentioned, I wrote about this story, to see a familiar face in Joe McNamara and then listen to him mention calamari was, it was a blast from the past. And I was laughing, but at the same time, I thought that is so great for Joe McNamara, who was very, as you mentioned, very serious about what squid and calamari means to Rhode Island.
So let's back up for a moment. You talked about a blast from the past. And of course, we had some fun coming up with some puns for today. So you did use a lot of ink reporting on calamari. And I have to ask, why is that a blast from your past? How did you wind up working on this story?
So in 2014, I was covering politics, but a story came across my desk from Rhode Island. And they had just passed a bill naming calamari the official state appetizer. And I thought, there's got to be more to this story. And my husband's from Rhode Island. I'm from Massachusetts. I know a little about the area and what food culture means to Rhode Island. And I just started kind of poking around. And the more I invested in this story, the deeper I went, the more people I talked to, the more research I did, it grew tentacles. And I just couldn't stop, because I'd get onto one subject, say, you know, Rhode Island politics, and then I'd veer off into another interesting subject, the rise of squid in America. And it became sort of 8 stories in one. And eventually I had to turn the faucet off and say, okay, I just have to write this now. And, yeah. And I did. And it was one of the funnest things I've ever worked on.
So, you know, I think there's a lot of people, including me, who before this didn't know there was a rise of squid in America. And I wonder if you can connect the dots for us. So Calamari winds up becoming kind of the king of Italian restaurants and TGI Fridays types places with appetizer menus. But as you say, it's also a story of deep Rhode Island politics with corruption in the mix. Connect those dots for us. How does this unfold?
Well, so I'm back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, eating squid was not a thing in America, certainly among Western audiences. It just wasn't. And in fact, researchers spent federal grant money and university time and resources trying to come up with ways to make squid more palatable to American audiences, and with very little success. Cut to the 80s with an influx of different kinds of cultural foods, Asians and Italians, and there was this new embrace of calamari, and it went from total obscurity to ubiquity in what felt like a matter of minutes, overnight. In fact, the New York Times started calling this phenomenon when a food, say kale or quinoa, goes from obscurity to ubiquity, the calamari index. And so it really was a phenomenon. And it meant a lot in particular to Rhode Island. Rhode Island has one of the largest squid landings on the northern seaboard, on the eastern coast. It's one of the biggest economic movers for the state. And so when Chairman McNamara had this idea to use one of the state's great resources and something that, you know, every Rhode Island restaurant is proud of, Rhode Island calamari, to boost the economy and the marketability of Rhode Island, he meant it. He, you know, it was not a silly PR move for him. For him, he really saw dollar signs, he saw publicity, he saw all good things from a state that I'm sure you know gets a lot of bad headlines.
So I want to talk about the fishing industry for a minute too, and to put kind of a serious note on it for a minute. Last night at the RNC, we heard from a Maine lobsterman, Jason Joyce, who spoke in favor of President Trump and his work reversing Obama administration actions to protect marine wildlife. Here he is.
I live on an island with 370 residents, and lobstering is how we provide for our families. As long as Trump is president, fishing families like mine will have a voice. But if Biden wins, he'll be controlled by the environmental extremists who want to circumvent long-standing rules and impose radical changes that hurt our coastal communities.
So we know that there are real struggles in the fishing industry in New England. We know that that is part of the story behind the rise of calamari or squid, as you talked about it, and this urgency to get squid into palatable recipes and mainstream dining. As a political observer, which you are you surprised today to see the New England fishing industry showing up in places like national conventions right now?
It really is remarkable on both sides of the aisle. And, you know, as a New Englander, I'm proud. As someone who likes to fish a lot, I think that's great that these issues are being highlighted. It's tough, though, in a convention, in a, you know, Rhode Island shout out during the roll call or a 3-minute speech to really delve into these very complex issues in a meaningful way. But at the very least, if it encourages people to, you know, read a little bit more or ask a few more questions about these industries, I think that's only positive.
Now, you talk about this confluence of events, political events and business events, that led to Representative McNamara being in the position to try to push for a state, an official state appetizer in calamari. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And was there controversy around passing legislation for an official state appetizer?
I mean, there was, and that's what in part got me so interested in this story, because this was not actually an easy legislative victory. It took time and convincing. There was political infighting. Chairman McNamara used some language out of The Godfather to describe what was going on. And I spoke to him today. We followed up because I wanted to check in with him. And he's real excited about the publicity, obviously, that this continues to get. But at the time, he had opposition, not only from Republicans who thought this was silly legislation. I think at the time there were only six in the legislature, but still. And from other lobby groups like the Quahoggers, you know, who wanted that kind of representation too. He had to remind them, no, you're already the official state shellfish, but you know, calamari squid deserves its day in the sun too. So he had to convince his own legislative body to take this seriously. And he had to convince Rhode Island voters as well, who have, as you know, strong feelings about their food culture. And so there was actually a lot of controversy around whether this was serious, whether this was going to be ultimately good for the squid industry, if it was going to punish other industries, if this was going to help make Rhode Island look better or worse. There was a lot that went into this that you wouldn't imagine with such a seemingly innocuous bill, but it wasn't innocuous.
So in our last minute or so, did it deliver? All right, I'm going to trot another pun. Does the Rhode Island economy have legs now that it didn't before because of this push for the calamari industry?
Well, yes and no. Chairman McNamara will tell you that it's been tremendous for Rhode Island tourism, both in the wake of its passing and later. They've had a calamari festival that's been very successful for the last 5 years, minus this one because of COVID. And he says demand has been up. All the fishing vessels are out. He says that economically, they've had their largest landing of 60 million squid just the last year. And he said that the DNC shout out got the Rhode Island restaurant industry the biggest boost it's ever gotten from any kind of publicity campaign. Now, the other side is Rhode Island's economy is still struggling, and it was struggling at the time. It's been struggling for decades. And that's because a lot of systemic problems. This bill and squid have not turned that around, but it's inarguable that the concentration on Rhode Island calamari has been good for the economy. Not a total salve, but certainly a boon.
Well, this has been fascinating. S.E. Cup is a political commentator and host of CNN's S.E. Cup Unfiltered and a columnist for the New York Daily News. You can find a link to her calamari reporting on our website, radioboston.org. S.E., thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.